You're on television today, huh?
Oh, yes, that was very exciting.
What was that? Where were you?
The Today Show.
Oh, the Today Show.
Yes.
Does the Today Show have viewers that read books?
Well, they have reviewers who hear little talks about books.
What was it like?
That probably does everything they need for them. It was for about 3 minutes. It was fine. Just what made you think of this book and what else? No, she didn't even ask that.
She asked a lot of Stevenson.
Yeah, she did. Actually, it was she asked questions I didn't expect, but they were easy to answer. Is that it?
No, I was in an interview a while back with John Updike. He had just come from an interview at the CBS Morning News.
Mm.
Who was the that blonde anchor? Diane Sawyer.
Oh, yeah.
Was the questioner. The first question she asked John was, right out of the blue, she said, what do women want from men?
Mm.
And John stutters.
Oh.
A little bit. And he said, frankly, he said he couldn't think of a thing he could answer. He said he got off some sort of answer, but he was so startled, he just... I couldn't think of anything to say to answer that question.
That question has plagued a lot of people for a long time. Although I once asked a friend who was a writer, and he's really perceptive, a similar question. I said, when a man looks at a woman, what does he see? And he said, he sees someone who wants what she should not want.
That's a good way to get around the question.
I thought in a way it said a lot, though.
You're teaching, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm teaching at University of Massachusetts now.
A creative writing?
That's right, and also a contemporary fiction course right now.
Tell me about yourself, and I understand you're from New Orleans.
Yeah, I grew up there. I've been up here about, this is my fourth year. I went to graduate school in New England also.
Where was that?
At the same university where I teach. Mm-hmm. University of Massachusetts in Amherst.
That's where Paul Thoreau went to school.
That's right. He was a little bit ahead of me.
Yeah.
He's been a lot ahead of me.
What's that?
He was a little bit ahead of me in time, and then he got a lot ahead of me.
Let's see. I was just interviewing someone else.
His
John Edgar Wideman.
Oh, yes. He's my colleague. We're in the same department.
Yeah,
he's in Africa right now for a couple of weeks. I just started working there in September. So I'm the new baby. And since I graduated from there, most of my colleagues were my teachers, which is a sort of strange situation.
Well, since you graduated from there, I guess you're used to the New England winters.
Well, I don't think that one gets used to the New England winters. But I've learned how to not think about them.
What was it like growing up in New Orleans?
It was wonderful. It's a wonderful city. It's very... different, I think, from any other American city. It doesn't seem American in many ways. And of course, you know, when you're a child and you grow up in a place, you think that's what the whole world is like. And so when I found out that the rest of the world was different, it was a surprise. I think that the most important thing for me about the city is that it's constantly sinking, disappearing, and nature is always ready to take over. And it's the people only live there by making an effort. Nature is not benign at all. When I go in New England, when I go and walk in the woods and there's no undergrowth and there's no poisonous snakes and there's no alligators and there's no... Well, there are mosquitoes, but nothing like the ones I remember as a child. It seems to me that a person who grows up in such a benign, beautiful environment is just going to have a whole different way of looking at things. Another thing about New Orleans, too, is that you can't get away from it, no matter how much money you have. You can't get away from the dangers of nature. And in most of my books, that's been rats, but there's also roaches, snakes, and bad weather, hurricanes, and bugs of all kinds. And I think that makes people feel differently about nature.
That's right. Rats have a big role to play in Mary Riley. Why do you have this feeling or obsession or concern about rats?
Yeah, I've been described as having an obsession with rats. I almost never think of them, actually. I had my picture taken holding a little toy rat today, though. That was pretty funny. I don't think it's an obsession. I think in the city that I grew up in, they're really a daily reality, and I've had lots of contact with them. I've had trouble with them in every house I've lived in. I got a house once that had a wonderful study on the second floor, and it was up in the trees, and I thought, this is going to be a great place to write. And about the third night I was in there, I had just a light so I could kind of see into the trees. It was a strange feeling to be surrounded by glass and trees. And I felt something looking at me, and there was a branch right next to the window, and there was a rat just watching me, which sort of ruined me. Although I thought, this is my study. I get to be watched by the rat. Another time I had I was doing a reading for some very wealthy ladies who lived uptown, surprising group, and they started talking about a scene with rats in one of my books, a book that has an outbreak of bubonic plague, and there's a scene in which a lot of rats die. And they started talking about their own experiences with rats in their houses and methods of killing rats that you caught in closets. And so I don't think it's an obsession. I think it's part of the environment that I grew up in. But it's also interesting because I think if there is an animal that socially people resemble, it's probably rats.
God, I hope not. I mean, the rats are really despicable. Of course, there are a lot of people who are, too.
They make it that way about people. And I think people resemble wolves. No, by socially, I mean they have the kind of rules that they have about who runs things and who doesn't and what to do. The way they respond to environmental pressures is very similar to people. They're one of the few animals that will just overpopulate and mess up their environment. Although, I think in some situations the birth rates will go way down if they're too crowded. There's been a lot of studies of rats' society. And whenever I read them, it always seems to me that they resemble people more than most animals. And they live, by choice, close to people, but not in any advocate capacity or any benign capacity the way dogs and cats do. And not they're dependent, but not in any a way that makes us feel good about ourselves.
Oh, they're really disgusting. I used to work for...
you don't like those, right?
No, I used to work for a television, a CBS TV affiliate in Baltimore. And Baltimore is a city that is laid out so that in the middle of every block there is an alley. Unlike New York City, you don't see too many alleys, at least in Manhattan. And at night I would come home and drive through the alley, and rats would scatter by the hundreds when they were caught in the beams of the headlights. It was really scary. And then when you get out of the car, it'd all be quiet. It'd be gone. But I used to take a cameraman. I would do some news stories because I was so startled by just the horror of seeing all these rats every night.
Yeah, there is something really sort of primordially horrifying about them. Of all of the animals, they seem to inspire such a... they're rather small.
But they look bigger.
they look
bigger in under the light of a headlight or something like that.
Yeah, and the experience I've had of having a live one and trying to deal with it and having a dead one and looking at it, when you look at one that's not a threat to you, you see that it's a perfectly ordinary animal. There's nothing extraordinary. It's not a very pretty animal, as animals go. They have those nasty tails, but it's not a terribly threatening creature. But something about the living creature is just frightening as no other animal seems to be.
Well, when I was a kid, I used to listen to the radio. In the late 1940s, early 50s, there still were some dramatic broadcasts and on radio, and one was on CBS. It was called Escape.
Mm.
I believe it was, I think William Conrad was in it. And I don't know if you ever ran across this radio show, but it was one of the most horrifying shows I ever heard. It was about two men who were lighthouse keepers, and they saw a ship, a derelict, approaching the lighthouse, which was way out in the water, not attached to a piece of coast. And all of a sudden, the boat moored itself to the lighthouse, and on this ship were hundreds and thousands of rats. They had just taken over the entire ship and reproduced in the way that you described. And naturally, they, on this little island where the lighthouse was, they all got off the boat and began clambering up the lighthouse, forcing the two lighthouse keepers to go up the hatch one by one, going higher and higher to escape the rats. It was really scary.
And this was a radio show?
It was a radio show. It was a drama called Escape.
Yeah. Well, just the thoughts of hordes of rats have always been very frightening. Of course, there's a good reason for that, too, as I learned when I wrote the book that has bubonic plague in it, and that is that because of the kinds of diseases that they have carried, especially bubonic plague, a lot of times when those diseases move into the human level, the first thing that will be a clue is that a lot of rats will die. And this exterminator who came to my house when I was complaining about rats said, just be glad they're alive. What we need to worry about is when they start dying in large numbers. That means that whatever this, in the case of bubonic plague, I believe it's a flea, that if the rat population starts to die, they're about to move up, and we're the next step.
Well, we digress a little bit. Now, you got your graduate degree in Amherst.
Yeah.
Where did you go to college?
I went to University of New Orleans.
Uh-huh. So all your formative years were spent in New Orleans.
Yeah, we moved there when I was three. I have no memory of living in Missouri at all, but we did live there for 3 years. My father was a sea captain, and so...
It's kind of a hard job to be a sea captain and live in Missouri, isn't it?
Well, it was impossible. That's why we moved to New Orleans.
Where were you born in Missouri?
Sedalia.
Uh-huh. My mother was born in Neosho. Do you know where that is?
No, but it's a familiar name.
Yeah. She went to Lindenwood, which was a women's college. It's called.
I used to go to Missouri in the summers to visit my grandparents, but I don't know too much about it. I don't feel very Midwestern at all. My mother's family was from New Orleans, and all the living relatives I have are still in New Orleans.
Anne Rice is back in New Orleans.
She said.
She was so cold in San Francisco, and such a good feeling to be back where it was humid.
Yeah, she moved back just as I left. I remember hearing that she was coming back when I moved up to teach at Mount Holyoke, and so I didn't get to meet her.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
Oh, not particularly. My mother was somebody who read all night. She never would sleep at night. She was always reading at night. We didn't get television until kind of late. My father, I think, had wanted to be a writer, but it was one of those things where World War II came along and he went to sea as a merchant marine and discovered that that's what he really loved. And he never did really, I don't think he could take rejection. It was a real problem.
Writers are meet rejection?
He's from time to time. And he couldn't take any. Not even a little. I remember he sent a story off and he got a good response that I understand now to have been an extremely enthusiastic one. It was suggested that he make certain changes. And he became very annoyed and never wrote anything else.
Oh, yeah. What do you think, why do you think you became a writer?
Well, I never was very good at anything else.
You wrote as a child?
Yeah, I really did. Rather silly stuff. But there was only a brief period when I wanted to be a veterinarian. Other than that, that's really all I've ever imagined I would like to be. And I just get a great deal of pleasure out of making up stories. I suppose it's a desire to escape reality and live in a world that you have total control over. I think that for a lot of writers, the page is one of the few places where they can feel powerful.
But when you got out of college, could you say to yourself, I'm going to be a writer? Or did you have to say to yourself, I'm going to have to do something to support myself and be a writer?
I think if you're realistic at all, you understand that you're going to have to do something to support yourself and try to keep the writing on the side as some sort of a secret vice that you don't want to tell people about. It's very difficult because... most people perceive of writers as people who make money by writing, and that doesn't usually happen for a very long time. Unlike most businesses, you can't show a profit on it usually until you've done many years of apprenticeship. And there's a sort of general, there's something laughable about a person who says they're a writer who hasn't published, as you may have experienced. So I just never said it, although I always thought it for a long time. In fact, I talked to my editor today, and I said, she said something about being a writer, and I said, well, you know, for a long time I really didn't think of myself as a writer. And I think it was this year that I finally able to put it on my passport and say that that's what I am.
But now this is your...
It's my fifth book.
Your fifth book, so, and this is...
It's not, I've written more books than that, but it's the fifth one that's been published.
Well, tell me about your first novel, it's Love?
Well, that's a collection of short stories, and it was put out by a small press that's still alive and that I'm now the managing editor of.
Well, what is the press?
It's called Lynx House Press.
I'm sorry?
Lynx House Press.
Mm-hmm.
You probably haven't heard of it. It was a press that we got together, or some friends of mine got together when I was in graduate school, and somehow or another they've managed to continue for over 15 years, putting out a few books every year. So that was some stories, most of which I wrote in graduate school. The first novel was set in motion, and that was in 78, I think. That was for R. Strauss. And that was the first novel that I wrote. I was fortunate in that it was published.
You sold your very first effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. That was good. But I still didn't think of myself as a writer because I couldn't make a living. I certainly couldn't live on what I was paid for that. So I was a teacher, and I thought of myself as a teacher who wrote. And there are millions of those in this country. They constitute an interesting group.
You, when you wrote Set in Motion, this was your first effort, I have been told that it's very difficult to teach writing, that most writers are really self-taught in some respects. But what elements did you have to work with in order to create this work of art? And I do consider writing works of art.
You mean that could be taught?
Yeah, I mean, how did you teach yourself to write? I guess that's the best way of phrasing it.
Well, I went to a writing program where I was taught to to write.
You actually were taught to write?
Well, I was in an MFA program, which is a writing program, and supposedly what you do in such a program is study writing. I don't think there is any way that you can teach somebody to be a writer. I think it's rather something that they are, and you can show them how to. You can save them a lot of time. That's basically what I do with students and basically what was done for me. People write. Everybody in the class looks at it. Everybody wants to write. Everybody talks about how they feel about what they... It sounds a little bit like psychotherapy, but it really isn't. And there are matters of pacing, creating a scene, a balance of scenes and summaries, the way you use time, especially in a novel. For me, one of the most interesting things about the novel is that there are three areas of time. There's the time that it's going to take the reader to read the book, which is presumably a couple of days if you're lucky. But it could be weeks, depending also on the size of your novel. If you write one of those big ones, then you're figuring on trying to take about a week out of the life of the average reader. There's the amount of time it's going to take you to write that, which is going to keep them occupied for a week, which can be anywhere from a year to 7 or 8 years or more. And then there's the actual time lapse in the book, that is, how much time passes from inside the narrative from the beginning of the book to the end of the book. For instance, this book probably covers about 6 or 8 months, except for a description of something that happened long ago. And it takes a long time to understand how to control over a long period of time a daily concentration, something that's going to be taken in rather rapidly and keep the reader's sense that they're in the time of the narrative. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
That they're actually living through the time of the narrative. I think it's taken me 5 books to feel like I have any mastery of that at all. It's so difficult.
A moment ago you mentioned rejection. I'm an amateur writer, and almost everything that I have sent out is rejected. I mean, I've reached the point now that I'm almost too lazy to pack up a short story and put it in a novel and send it off again because I know it's going to be rejected again.
It's very disheartening.
Yeah. You know, so what do you tell your students when they come across this?
To be ready for a lot of rejection. I think the only way to get through it is if you really take pleasure in the writing and and understand that the business of marketing fiction has very little to do with that pleasure. And if what you're writing for is a desire to make money or see things into print, which is pleasurable, I don't knock it, and I certainly want it, and always wanted it, it's not going to be enough if there's not some sort of pleasure in the actual creation of a story that pleases you and in the sort of daily work. When I left school with some writers whose work I admired and I thought were very good, I felt like I was in this pack and we were breaking from the gate and we were running. And every once in a while I'd look back and see a really good writer open a shoe store or a restaurant and just give it up. And sometimes I thought, you know, why don't you quit? But I never felt much inclination to quit.
Let's talk about Mary Riley. What prompted you to write this book? What gave you the idea for it? Well, I guess we know what gave you the idea.
Robert Louis Stevenson gave me the idea. I've modeled things on stories that I admire before. And it's an odd sort of exercise. A lot of writers don't seem interested in doing it, and I recommend it to students as something they might try, but I certainly don't think that it's something that every writer has to do. But in a way, I think I've taken stories that I admire, like a Hawthorne story or a story by James Joyce, The Dead, which is a very famous story, and sort of done my own version of them. I didn't notice until recently that these were all stories by men and that what I did was a female version of them. My story that's modeled on The Dead, Joyce's story, is about a man who goes to a party, is humiliated by women, and then he has an encounter with death. My story is about a woman who goes to a party, is humiliated by a young man, and has an encounter with death. Nobody would notice that these two stories have this in common. I don't think nobody's ever mentioned that they noticed it. But my Hawthorne stories, he had young Goodman Brown who has an encounter with the devil, and I have a young woman who has an encounter with a wolfman. So I've amused myself by putting women in the heavyweight, in the big guy's storyline before. So it didn't seem like a shocking thing for me to think of. Stevenson's book is remarkably free of women, and except for this maid. When I've taught the book, I've always been interested in that little scene in which this maid appears and weeps and wondered, well, who is she? And it occurred to me that she would know things about Jekyll and Hyde that nobody else would have been in a position to know. I guess all those things made me want to start thinking about telling the story.
Isn't it taking a risk to take someone else's fiction and rework it as your own?
Well, I like to try hard things. I don't see much point in not taking risks. It seemed to me that I had set myself a very hard task because everybody already knew the secret that my character didn't know. Everybody's familiar with the story, so my story had better be pretty interesting on its own. Otherwise, people would just go read the original. Why read mine? I don't like to think of it as a retelling. I like to think of it as a story that runs parallel, mm-hmm. A story of somebody inside of another book who has her own life and view. That is as interesting fictionally as Stevenson's character.
Tell me about the language in the book, which is somewhat unusual. I guess it's Victorian language.
Yeah, Mary's voice. It took me a while to find that voice. Once I did, I couldn't get rid of it. I still hear it. You know, still when I try to write things, I have a tendency to slip into Mary's voice. I made a few stabs. I had one voice that sounded a lot like Jane Eyre's. Somebody has pointed out to me recently that this book is very similar to Jane Eyre. And the voices that I was trying were too artificial and they were too close to my own. So I read journals by women who worked in the period. And also, as a teacher all these years, I've taught students who are foreign language students, students who are not, I guess, what we would call particularly literate, especially at University of New Orleans. I taught these remedial writing courses to people who's they were either coming into English from another language, or they just didn't have much experience with writing standard English. And I noticed the sorts of problems that invariably appear, that verb to be is just very hard to learn in English. It gives people a lot of trouble. There's a tendency to put clauses together in a certain way with this which Mary has. She'll say, and this is such and such, which is such and which, she'll string those clauses together to put prepositional clauses together in certain ways. I've been looking at it for so long that I feel real familiar with the struggle of somebody coming into literacy. And sometimes these students write with such charm that when I get them to be able to pass a freshman exam, I feel like I really haven't done them a service, because they've lost that sort of individual quality that characterized their pre-literate scrawlings. I had that experience with a Greek student one time who just had this charming way of writing. Once we got him through the exam, it was gone. He still had it in his speech, but he didn't write like he spoke anymore, which seemed like it wasn't a service. So anyway, I felt familiar with the struggle of somebody who can't write very well because of not mastering ordinary syntax, trying to express what she sees on a sort of daily basis. And the voice seemed to come quite naturally to me.
Well, Mary has a kind of a Cockney accent.
Mm-hmm.
Is this authentic? I mean, or did you use your imagination in developing the language?
Well, there is a diary by a woman named Hannah Colwick, which has survived, and she married her boss, finally, who was a gentleman, and he made her keep diaries for years, a very strange relationship. Someone directed me to those diaries early on. If Mary's voice resembles anybody's, it's hers. But she's less literate than Mary is, and she certainly is not as thoughtful. She tends to just record what she did, and it's these lists of, you know, swept the carpets out of the tea leaves, did the polish the stoves, help cook with the meat, took the ladies down to the corner to see the show, and she just goes through the details of her day. But I think the sort of cockney quality of Mary's voice began to enter my head.
Ah,
through reading her.
I was going to ask you about some of the period details in there. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they were in the original Jekyll and Hyde, the things that Mary did on a daily basis that
yeah.
she cleaned. And I was wondering, you might had to do a certain degree of research to have that information.
Yeah, I did quite a bit. I read diaries of working people. The period is very well documented. There was a fellow named Mayhew who wrote something of the working poor, the working classes in London. Anyway, every week in the newspaper, he would go and interview some class of workers, seamstresses, dock workers. He didn't really do household servants too much. And then he'd publish his interviews. There's some rollicking, funny interviews with boys who were just loose on the streets and called themselves beggars. He would just jot down everything that they said. He had a very good ear, very, very precise. So I read a lot of that, which gave me a notion of how people spoke. I found some diaries by servants in country houses. For some reason, those tended to survive more than servants in the city. And that gave me some idea of the kind of diction and also the kind of daily work that was involved in keeping a big house. For instance, Mary is constantly sweeping the carpet out with tea leaves. I know that this was done. I have no idea how or why. But I just had her do it. I know they use paraffin to light the coal stoves, the coal burners that they heated the houses with in London, but I don't know what they used the paraffin for. And I haven't been able to find anybody who can tell me that.
I'm glad I read Mary Riley. You know, the strange story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a book that most of us assume we have read.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all know the story.
Right.
And I realized as I read Mary Riley that I hadn't read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'd seen one of the movie versions, one or more of the movie versions. Mm-hmm. I must have read the classic comics version when I was a kid.
Yeah, I think I read that one too.
But it dawned on me that there were a lot of details in this book that had to be in the original Robert Louis Stevenson novel that I didn't recall. And so then it dawned on me that no, I had not read the original Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I did, however, last week I went to the New York Public Library and I borrowed a tape of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, read by Anthony Quayle.
Oh, I bet that's good.
It is good. I've only had a chance to hear the first half of it. So, but it's...
It's a book that wants to be read out loud. That would be a very good way to see it, because Stevenson has a charming style and a very distinct voice. I would think that would be a really good way to...
This is a condensation. The story is told from the perspective of the doctor, whose name escapes me. The doctor in the book.
Dr. Lanyon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's told from his perspective. So I don't know how much editing they did.
The whole thing is just Lanyon's narrative?
Up to the first half.
Because the original book has three parts. It's only 70 pages long. It's a very short book. And the first part is narrated by a third-person narrator. The second part is Lanyon's narrative, which is found after Jekyll is dead. And the third part is another manuscript, which is Jekyll's full statement of the case, written by Jekyll right before he died. And that's the whole book. That's all there is to it.
But isn't it interesting that the assumptions that we make when we think we're so familiar with an entity? Now, I'm sure that I've never read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
No, I have never read Frankenstein myself.
But we all know the story.
Yeah.
I don't
think we do know that story, because I think the movie versions of Frankenstein are really different from Mary's. I think at least in the movie versions of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, there's some resemblance to the original story.
Yeah, there's so many movie versions that...
I think Frankenstein's a sort of heroic character, finally, isn't he? I haven't read it.
Or Dracula, for that matter. I'm sure I've never read Dracula.
No, that's a wonderful book. I have read that one. That and its versions don't resemble the original very much.
As I began realizing that I had not read the original Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I began to think that my literary background is very limited. You know, as I look back, you know, it seems to me that most of the great books that I read as a youngster I was compelled to read when I was in high school or my early days in college. Although I was a big reader, but the classics, I don't think I read very much of unless I was compelled to do so.
I don't think I read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde until I was teaching and sort of casting around for a little something to use for sophomore students that would be attractive to them in a course where they read a whole lot of different novels. And I wanted a good Victorian, sort of literate yet fun book for them to read, and came across it and thought, well, it's just charming.
Yeah, that would be a better choice than, say, Silas Marner.
Yeah. Yeah, they liked it. And I also enjoyed that they all had your response. They all thought they knew the story. They felt that they had probably read it.